From KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Maggie Waugh. Passionate testimony from both sides is heard at public hearings on Ballot Measure 1, which is aimed at protecting fish habitat. A new study hopes to discover the implications of hatchery pink salmon spawning with wild fish. The man who was instrumental in financing initial efforts to stop the Pebble Mine has died. And finally, consumers want earth-friendly fishing and see ocean pollution as the biggest threat to fish. We'll have all that coming up on this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report right after this.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund, supporting conservation and harvesting of Alaska's wild, sustainable fisheries.
The state is holding a series of public hearings throughout Alaska on Ballot Measure 1, which is aimed at protecting salmon habitat. The measure would toughen the state's permitting requirements for projects built in salmon habitat. Last Tuesday, Lieutenant Governor Byron Malotte stopped in Nome to host a public hearing on Ballot Measure 1. Citizens were invited to speak for 2 minutes on the initiative, or they could submit a written testimony. Sponsored representatives from both sides spoke. If Ballot Measure 1 were passed, one major change would be the creation of a two-tiered permitting system. Projects would be considered either minor or major when applying for fish habitat permits. If a project is considered major, it would have to undergo a public review. Marliana Hall was born and raised in Nome and serves as the executive director of the Resource Development Council of Alaska and spoke as the chair of Stand for Alaska, Vote No on Ballot 1. Hall noted that her campaign believes that if the initiative were to pass, projects such as upgrading the wastewater facility in the Snake River or expanding the Nome Airport could all be in jeopardy. Hall also spoke to KNOM personally outside of her capacity with Vote No on 1 and expressed anxiety that the initiative could threaten projects that help develop communities, citing the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. She says that Alaskan natives especially could benefit from these jobs.
When we see outside interests come in and push an initiative like this that will not help our native corporations, will not help our rural communities, I personally become very concerned with it, and it makes me sick to think about the outside interests that are influencing the way that we manage our fish habitat across the state.
Mike Wood spoke as a sponsor for Stand for Salmon, saying that the initiative is timely, as the state has so many large hard rock mining proposals. He noted Fish and Game is smaller as a department than it was when the pipeline was built.
With the amount of development that was bearing down on the state, it would be to our advantage economically, since fish are such a driving economic force in the state, to implement some of these laws. And at this point, it's time to have some more robust standards to be sure that we don't trade one resource for another.
The meeting drew citizens on both sides. Ukalesok Oklesik, vice president of Sitnasok Native Corporation, specifically mentioned that the ballot initiative had not been communicated enough to Alaska Native tribes and corporations. Those in favor of the ballot think that it will give citizens a say in the projects happening in their community. Eric Osborne, a commercial fisherman of over 40 years, delivered this message in support of the initiative.
You're not just protecting salmon, but you're protecting human populations that depend on them and animal populations that depend on them. You're protecting the food chain, the viability of the land to support people, and the value of the land, because lands have value when they have fish. This is an exercise in intellectual honesty and cultural responsibility toward our resource in our lives.
This meeting in Nome was just one of several that are being held throughout the state.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, on the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Recently, an argument over whether hatcheries are causing more harm than good has been heating up. The debate is nothing new, But an Alaska Department of Fish and Game study is about to take a step toward answering a question central to the debate. Do hatchery fish that spawn with wild populations pose a threat to those stocks? From Alaska's Energy Desk, Aaron Bolton has the story.
Okay, so basically you want to make two cuts, one to get at the heart and one to get at the otoliths.
Pete Rand is a research ecologist with the Prince William Sound Science Center, and he's showing a group of new field staff how to sample pink salmon carcasses on the banks of Hartney Creek, just outside of Cordova. Rand picks up one of several pinks lined up on the rocks in front of him, and cuts just behind its gills before using a pair of tweezers to tear off a tiny piece of its heart. Then he cuts into the skull, or brain case as he calls it, and extracts two white otoliths, or ear bones. They're smaller than the head of a pin.
I basically put my fingers in the eye socket, and you basically want to just take the top of the head off. Again, be very careful. You don't want to go
under a microscope. Fishing Game will be able to tell from the ear bones if each fish was raised in a hatchery. In just a few days, three field crews will travel to five remote streams on the western side of the sound, where they will repeat this ritual thousands of times.
We sample from the very beginning of the spawning season all the way to the end, and we sample daily. And so the objective there is to sample as many of the spawning pink salmon as we can.
This study and previous work has shown that the closer a wild stream is to a hatchery, the more likely hatchery fish will stray into that system.
Streams that are generally in the western part of the sound and generally closer to the hatcheries have relatively high hatchery fractions, up 70, 80, sometimes 90%.
The big concern is that when those strays spawn with wild fish, they're passing on genes that could reduce future generations' genetic fitness. In other words,
does having a hatchery origin parent, does that influence your survival in nature? And so that's the ultimate question we're trying to get at with this field project.
To answer that question, the samples are shipped to Fish and Game's genetics lab in Anchorage. Any heart tissues belonging to hatchery fish are discarded, but the ones from wild pinks are processed.
And we take a small piece of that heart and then put it in a tube, add a bunch of chemicals, go through a bunch of different reactions, and pull out the DNA.
Chris Hobbish manages the lab. He explains that after about a week of processing, his team can identify lineages of wild pinks and fish with varying degrees of genes passed down from hatchery stocks. The number of returning offspring each family tree produces will indicate whether hatchery fish reduce the productivity of wild stocks they spawn with. But that's about as far as the answers will go.
So if we do find a difference between these natural origin, hatchery origin fish in terms of how many progeny they produce, we won't know what the mechanism for that difference is.
While that may be a step forward in Fish and Game's eyes, the study has its critics. They argue the project, which received a large chunk of funding from hatchery operators and processors, is biased, and that it doesn't include a control stream with little or no hatchery influence to compare results to. Bill Templin is Fish and Game's chief fisheries scientist. In his Anchorage office, he acknowledges some of the study's shortcomings.
So it's very difficult to find a control. What we did, though, is controlled for high stray rate streams and low stray rate streams, so you get some sense of a contrast.
Templin says what the study does provide shouldn't be overlooked. He says the results will be valuable to the department and the Board of Fisheries when hatcheries request production increases or other permit changes. But he cautions against any notion that this study will spark a major shift in hatchery management. He says it's just a first step, and that the results alone might not be the best way to answer the question at the heart of the hatchery debate.
Questions of how much is too much or whether there's harm or not are very difficult to answer because they also require a human valuation, a huge human judgment. That has to be worked out in a different venue than in a scientific study.
For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska fishermen and their families. MC@amsea.org or 907-747-3000. 3287.
Anchorage financier Robert Gillum, a powerful opponent of the proposed pebble mine in southwest Alaska, has died. Gillum was instrumental in efforts to oppose the mine. Anti-pebble campaigner Tim Bristol says that it was especially true in the early years.
It was Bob's leadership, Bob's resources, frankly, in the short term that have made this into the movement that it is.
Gillum spent millions in campaigns against the mine. He helped convince other pro-development Republicans, including the late Senator Ted Stevens, to oppose the project. Bristol, who was working for Trout Unlimited when he first met Gillum in 2006, says Gillum worked well with environmentalists, too.
I could sit down with him and discuss 10 issues, and we might disagree on 9 of them, but we agreed on conservation of Bristol Bay.
Associates say Gillum suffered an apparent stroke at his Anchorage home last week and was taken to the intensive care unit at Providence Hospital, where he died last Wednesday. Seafood lovers around the world believe that the biggest threat to the ocean is pollution, followed by overfishing. Alaska Fish Radio's Lainey Welch has more.
Those are some of the top takeaways from a survey this year of over 25,000 people in 22 countries. The survey was done by the public opinion research firm GlobalScan for the Marine Stewardship Council. The nonprofit MSC led the movement 20 years ago towards certifying fisheries that are managed sustainably. Sourcing seafood from earth-friendly fisheries has become a requirement of doing business by most seafood buyers around the globe. The study found that 72% of seafood consumers want sustainability verifications at their supermarkets, but price is still the biggest motivator for buying decisions. 72% also agreed that buying seafood from sustainable sources will help save our oceans. 70% said people should switch their purchases to well-managed fisheries. Younger consumers are even more tuned in to choosing sustainable seafood, with 41% of 18 to 34-year-olds understanding what the Marine Stewardship Council label means. That younger group also showed a slightly different profile, eating less seafood on average and worrying more about the effects of climate change on the oceans than their older counterparts.
That was Lainey Welch from Alaska Fish Radio.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs, 1-800-992-4960, or online at alaskaboat.com.
That's it for this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report. We had lots of help this week, including from Emily Hofstetter at KNON in Nome, Elizabeth Harbaugh, and Aaron Bolton with the Alaska Energy Desk. We also had help from Liz Ruskin at Alaska Public Radio and from Lainey Welch at Alaska Fish Radio. As always, a big thank you to everyone who helps make this program possible each week, including your listeners and the radio stations that make it possible for you to hear the program. From KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Maggie Wall.